Hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated.
Good morning. We're delighted to see you all today, and especially want to greet Waukesha South High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. And we greet also Faith Christian School. Would those students please stand? Thank you all for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a National Prize winning program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from across the state are invited to come and join us for an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation of the briefs of the case they are to hear sent to them, they may do extra work on this case. If they come to oral argument, and after oral argument, after the second case of oral argument, they will meet with a justice of the court who will discuss the procedures of the court in hearing and determining cases, not the substantive issues involved in the case. Everyone is welcome to join with that justice after the second case. We've met you. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you will meet today. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to Justice Bradley's left, Justice David Prosser. And to his left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'm going to now call our first case for today, which is 04-0770CR, State v. Eric W. Ray. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Ray is Brian Huff. And then Ms. Lawrence, Assistant Attorney General, will argue on behalf of the state. Counsel?
Thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the court. I am Attorney Brian Howe. I do represent the defendant, Eric Ray. May it please the court. Would the court like a brief recitation of the facts?
Just very briefly, counsel. The court's familiar with the facts and has read your appendix, which sets forth the colloquy between the court and Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Your Honor. With that, I believe the facts aren't difficult to follow. This is a third offense drunk driving case. The primary issue here involves the facts relating to the jurors' statements to the court during the polling and the court's inquiry of that juror during the polling. As the court is aware, the juror did state that he did not agree with the verdict as read to the court, and the problems which followed that statement are what is at issue today.
Well, didn't he, before he said no, he asked a question. So it was it equivocal or unequivocal? In other words, the juror's question.
The juror's question provided no ambiguity to the response to the polling question. The juror's question was simply, can I ask a question? There was no substance to his question other than, may I ask a question? And I would submit that there's no ambiguity in that. He just had a procedural inquiry. And I would submit to the court that that was not an ambiguity.
Under Cartagena, would it have been appropriate for the court to deal with the question before continuing the poll?
Under Cartagena, the The court did deal with the question.
But he dealt with it after he finished the poll. My question is, should he, would it have been appropriate, maybe I should say, would it have been appropriate for the court to stop at that point, get the question, clarify any difficulties before continuing and finishing the poll of the other members?
I would say the answer to that is yes, and I would follow that with, I believe he did, by instructing the juror to respond to the poll question.
But he continued the polls. I guess what I'm trying to do is, I'm trying to discern where the line should be. If it is permissible, and we have to decide whether it is, but if it's permissible to clarify ambiguities, when do you do that? Do you do it when the ambiguity comes up? Do you do it after the poll is complete? And does that create other problems? Do you understand the gist of my question?
I believe so. I'll attempt to respond to it. The court did have an does have an obligation to clear up ambiguities. And if the court concludes that the question, may I ask a question, constitutes an ambiguity, then the court does have an obligation to, or has the discretion, I should say, to question that juror as to his response to the poll.
Your problem is that before the court did that, he finished the poll, which got the answers from the other jurors.
The problem is that the juror did answer the question, the juror did say no, the juror did dissent, and upon the dissent, the court had an obligation at that point, once he got the no answer, to cease questioning, to cease the poll. Completing the poll, Your Honor, presents a problem because it reveals the split in the jury. And as stated in Brasfield, that's a problem. It's a problem in the jury room when the jurors are deliberating for the court to come in and ask about the numerical split without even knowing whether there's who's for or against the jury. In this case, we have the numerical split revealed publicly.
Counsel, why is that a problem? I mean, the jurors knew how they voted, so this isn't new news to them. I'm having a hard time understanding why it's a problem that the court finished the poll rather than stopping right away with Mr. Clark and letting everybody else go back to the jury room and asking questions.
The problem with finishing the poll is because in the public setting, in front of the judge, in front of the lawyers, in front of the public, in front of the whole courtroom, the lone dissenter has to announce that, hey, I am the person who has a problem with this. That puts the spotlight on that individual.
Well, Counselor, it could have been the 12th juror. This wasn't the 12th juror, but it could have been the 12th juror that was polled. You can never solve that problem then if that's the test. Because you'd always have the split by the time you got to him, right?
I would agree with the court. If it were the 12th juror, then we wouldn't have an issue with continuing the poll. But in the case where we do have someone raising his hand and saying no, that serves no useful purpose. Nothing was to be gained by completing the poll.
Well, you may be right about that, but I'm not sure that's a test to get us to overturn a verdict. And I'm more concerned about something that's prejudicial to his rights to a fair and reliable result from the jury. And if we had the same effect, if it were the 12th juror, then I have a hard time with drawing the line where you're asking me to draw it. Do you see where I'm having a problem?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
But for
let me just interrupt for a minute. If the concern that you're expressing now relates to in some way bringing a coercive situation upon this juror, in this particular case, wasn't that taken care of by the way that Judge Lupke discussed with the juror that we're not bringing any pressure on you, we're not in any way trying to force you to decide one way or the other? I'm paraphrasing what he was saying, but I thought as I listened to the colloquy that occurred and as I read it in the briefs, that he was very careful not to in any way suggest to the juror that the juror should give up his beliefs, and was trying to assist the juror by providing a transcript. So where does the coercion take place in all of this?
Your Honor, the The jurors said no, he does not agree with the verdict. After he said no and questioning took place of that individual, I would argue to the court that whenever you question someone's decision, that's putting pressure on that person. The judge should not be questioning the juror about his vote. The lawyer should not be questioning the juror about his vote. The jurors should be the only ones questioning the holdout about his or her vote.
But that's deliberation.
Don't we have the situation first where the juror is expressing that he has a question?
He does have a question.
Isn't it appropriate for the judge to see if there is a way of assisting the jury? Lots of times, as you know, the jurors will send out a written question, and usually that will be addressed by the court, usually with the defendant and counsel also present. You have that situation here. You've got the defendant present. You've got counsel present. The juror says, I got a question. What's wrong with finding out what that question is and trying to accommodate that juror?
I don't have a problem with accommodating a question. The problem arises, though, once the juror in this case says no, he does not assent to the verdict. Because that happened, that changes the landscape here. The juror said no, and there's nothing that the judge, the lawyers, or anyone in the courtroom should have attempted to do to try to influence that no answer. Any words coming from the judge have the potential to impact that juror's decision. As we all know, when the judges speak, their words carry great, significant, and substantial weight, as they should. Every single word from the judge is important and critical. That juror could well have viewed the judge's inquiry of him as an effort to pressure him to explain his vote in open court. And the jurors should never, ever have to explain why they're dissenting in open court. That is reserved for the jury room in the deliberations.
But that didn't happen here. I mean, he didn't. He had this question, and the judge, as Justice Crooks indicated, was trying to help the juror. And I'm just so your point is that if the question was asked, the judge should have then stopped it right there and dealt with it, obviously outside of the presence of the other jurors, because that's the only way. How would the judge have handled it any other way?
I would submit that was within the judge's discretion. The judge had the option of sending the jury back to resolve the question there. The juror could have sent out the question in writing. That was an option.
No,
that's an option.
You take issue with the fact that Judge Lupke dismissed the other jurors and asked the question of this juror in open court?
That is part of the problem, because by isolating this individual in open court to conduct the interrogation of this person increases this, what I would classify as an unspoken pressure. And that's the unspoken pressure that's talked about in Brasfield. It's difficult for the appellate courts to fully understand the coercive tendencies, and there, that's why Brasfield said, let's not even touch it. That's a problem.
Well, I think some of us have been in trial court before. I mean, I was a trial judge for a number of years, and that is the recommended way how to handle something. You're suggesting that we would send the whole jury back, or in other words, take the person into chambers and then ask the question? That could be, I'd have some trouble with that. Or you're saying send the whole jury back and then have him send the question out that way?
That would be within the court's discretion. And I also think it would be within the court's discretion to ask the juror what his question is. I believe that's a discretionary choice.
But not in the presence of the other jurors. I mean, you're not suggesting, that's what I'm trying to understand.
I don't have a problem with the court asking the juror what his question is in open court. I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem, though, after the juror says, no, this is not my verdict.
Right.
That questioning was done of this juror about relating to his verdict.
If I'm understanding your point correctly, it wasn't the fact that it was done that's troublesome. It was the fact of how it was done and the sequence of events that led to how it was done. Is that correct?
Yes.
Counsel, you've a couple of times made reference to the Brasfield case in support of your arguments. It's an easy opinion to read. It's pretty short. And it seems to me that the facts are that I'm reading a little bit into it, because it's short on facts, too. But it seems to me the facts are that this jury was taken quite some time, and the judge some way inquired of the jury, I don't know how, hey, what's the split? Isn't that different than the way that you're using the case in reference to this case? That is, you don't have the judge here saying, hey, jury, what's the split? Your argument is by continuing the poll, he is then doing what the Burton court, which is cited in Brasfield, said you can't do. The court condemned the practice, and I'm reading from Brasfield, of inquiring of a jury unable to agree the extent of its numerical division. Now, the court, the Supreme Court in Brasfield was quite emphatic about that as I read this opinion and found that as reversible error. Don't fool around. That's it. Over and done with. But why is the fact situation in Brasfield all that similar to this?
Thank you, Your Honor. The problem is this. In my impression of Brasfield is that by requiring or asking the jurors to inform the court as to what the split is, that in and of itself puts a pressure on each and every juror. That pressure is magnified when it occurs in open court. That's my reading of Brasfield. If the problem exists in the deliberating room, then the problem is magnified when it occurs publicly. And the problem is that the jurors should not be in the position where they have to reveal what the split is. And here we've got, once the juror says, no, this is not my verdict, we have a non-unanimous verdict, we have a split, and by forcing the jury to reveal the total split, sets up the problem that occurred in Brasfield. It's the same situation. It's unnecessary, it served no useful purpose, and it does put a pressure on the dissenter or dissenters.
Did you speak up right away and object to this, Mr. Howe?
Your Honor, when the juror said, no, it is not my verdict, the court said, continue with the polling. There was no objection made at that point in time. It appeared to me that when the court was instructing the judicial assistants to continue with the polling, that was not really an opportunity for a defense counsel to object. If defense counsel pulls an objection at that point in time, it's, I believe, as a trial lawyer, I think it would pose a problem for me. As soon as there was a recess, we moved for a mistrial.
Well, let me ask this. Are there any problems with the transcript?
There was one problem with the transcript.
What was that?
It was a statement was misallocated to me that was actually allocated, was from the court, but that was corrected by an errata sheet.
What statement was that? The one that said, what can we do to help you?
The statement was, after a prosecutor questioned the juror, I said, that's enough.
Right.
And then,
yes. There's a statement, what can we do to help you? And that's the court statement.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Part of the problem, Your Honors, with questioning the dissenter, once the dissenter has said, no, it is not my verdict, any statements from the judge become crucial because, as I stated, they may impact that juror's ultimate decision, and it doesn't serve any purpose other than to potentially confuse this juror or set up a problem. In this case, the juror was given misinformation by the judge. The judge said that a compromise verdict would be acceptable, and I do not believe that to be the law. I believe that the jurors are required to apply fact to law and make a decision, and compromise has no place in the decision-making. They should never compromise their values. And whether I'm misinterpreting the judge's statement or not, I believe it's confusing, and the judge just simply should not have been speaking to the juror in those terms.
Okay, well, I gather that your view of this is Judge Poles gets to Clark. Clark says, I have a question. Should the judge then have tried to decide whether that raised ambiguity?
Yes.
Is that, how would the judge have gone about that?
The judge was authorized to evaluate the juror's demeanor, tone of voice, body language, and his statements. And if the court did conclude that that was an ambiguous statement, then the court had the discretion to question that juror.
Okay. So the judge could have questioned the juror at that moment.
Yes.
Okay. What would be an appropriate question rather than an inappropriate question? Because you can't, I gather, pierce the juror's mind as to exactly what's bothering him, and the judge never did ask him what's bothering him, but sent him back to the jury room and told him to decide what particular parts of the transcript he might want to get copies of, right?
Yes.
Okay. So what should the judge have said to the juror?
At the moment when the juror says,
I have a question. Yeah.
I believe the judge had the discretion to allow the juror to ask his question at that moment in time,
all right,
in open court.
All right. With the other jurors present.
Yes.
And the guy would say something like, didn't fully understand the expert witness, so I had trouble reaching a decision. I mean, I'm assuming that's what he might say.
Yes.
Okay, then what should the judge have done?
The judge is undergoing an evaluation of the juror's demeanor, body language, his statements, and he's making a decision as to whether or not that there is an assent or a dissent. The judge can ask questions, and the judge can allow the lawyers to voir dire the juror if the judge believes that's appropriate under those circumstances.
What should he have done? Should he have then said after the juror says, well, I'm not sure I understood the expert, I'm not sure I can get it back to the time of driving, should the judge have then said, is this your verdict or not? Should the judge have said that? Or should the judge have said, any questions, Mr. Howe, any questions, Assistant DA? I'm sort of trying to figure out what is the ideal and then match it up with what happened.
I believe the court needs to make a determination as to whether or not the juror is answering the question. If the juror is making statements such as, I don't believe there's sufficient evidence, I need more information, then I believe at that point the judge would then have an obligation to decide that this juror is not convinced and this juror has doubt. And once doubt exists, send them back for further deliberations. But not help the juror with his decision making.
Mm-hmm.
That's for the other jurors to do.
Mm-hmm.
Answer the question, determine if that juror has some doubt. If the juror is not assenting to the verdict, send them back.
I'll give you more transcript if you want it.
If the juror is requesting transcripts, and the judge has decided he's going to send the jury back for further deliberations, what I would do is discuss that issue with counsel, and make a decision. We would get input from prosecutor and defense attorney before a transcript is sent back.
Mr. Hall, let's assume for a minute that the judge could have handled this in a more appropriate fashion. The state takes the position, even if there was some error here, that it was harmless in nature. What's your response to that?
I believe whenever there's the possibility of coercion, that's not going to be a harmless problem, especially in a case as close as this one. The jury returned a not guilty verdict on the drunk driving, on the operating while intoxicated. The evidence was not clearly in favor of the state. This was a close and tight, hard-fought case. And we have a lab analyst who cannot state with certainty what the blood alcohol concentration was at the time of operation. With that in mind, this is a close case, and any slight pressure put on the juror to sway his vote one way or another is probably. So I would not agree that this error is harmless. I think at this critical and delicate juncture, it had to be handled right. It wasn't, and therefore we have error that is reversible.
The jury returned a verdict of guilty on the BAC charge?
Yes.
And that appears to be what was troubling the juror, Mr. Clark.
Yes.
And that's why he wanted the transcript.
Correct.
Doesn't that seem to support the idea that what happened here was appropriate? In other words, that this was what was troubling the juror, the court was able to determine that, and therefore provide a transcript so the juror could make up his mind. I mean, none of that strikes me as some terrible, horrible thing where even if it was error, the way the judge handled it, that it wasn't harmless in nature. I'm having trouble not coming to the conclusion this was harmless. I think that's a question.
I don't believe, and I tried the case, that the transcript supported the juror's verdict. I believe that any pressure that came down from the judge to make a decision may have influenced the juror to turn from no to yes, because it was so very close, and because that transcript did not really support his ultimate decision. We don't know the extent of the coercive tendencies of the judge's actions. We can never, unless we interrogated the judge, the jury, and everybody, it's hard to say exactly how coercive it was. But because of the coercive tendencies, because we know that there is the potential that the judge's words impacted the juror, and caused him to change his mind.
Did you object to the transcript going into the jury room?
No. But once the transcript was being, once what was decided, what was going into the jury room, I moved for a mistrial.
And was that on the basis that what had occurred was coercive?
That was my impression. What I stated to the court, though, that the verdict was not unanimous. And I see that my red light is on.
You may continue the answer.
The motion for a mistrial was based upon the lack of unanimity in the verdict. I believe that there was a problem with the way it all played out. I did not particularize my objection, though, but I believe that I made it clear to the court that we were not going along with the way that this case was handled. As soon as the case was concluded, we filed a post-conviction motion. And then the final thing I would point out with regard to the issue of waiver is this, that this is the court's duty upon its own motion. That's what the Court of Appeals has already ruled. On the court's own motion, the court must send the jury back or declare a mistrial. And that's what should have happened here, regardless of whether or not I particularized my objection. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Howe. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Sarah K. Larson, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Sarah Larson, and I represent the State in this case. I'd like to make two main points to the Court today. First, the trial court properly exercised its discretion in conducting this jury poll because the Court's limited inquiry of Foreman Clark clarified his ambiguous response. Second, and probably most importantly, under the totality of the circumstances here, the trial court's jury polling procedures were not coercive, and therefore, this Court should affirm the conviction as a proper exercise of the Court's discretion. My first point today is that the trial court should have discretion to conduct its polling procedures in the way that it sees fit, and to be able to make a limited inquiry for the purpose of clarifying a juror's ambiguous response.
Ms. Larson, doesn't it single that individual juror who expressed the question, doesn't it single that juror out if you continue the poll, ask the other jurors, after being confronted with a no answer, a lack of assent to the verdict, doesn't it single that juror out and kind of put pressure on that juror, particularly when you call them back and say, is there anything we can do to help you?
State submits that the continuation of the polling does not do anything more to single out the juror than the juror already did by singling himself out, by saying, I don't understand, I have this question. And as Justice Rogenczak indicated, the jury presumably already knew about this juror's hesitation with the facts, because during deliberations, the foreman presumably made this discussion about the chemist's testimony.
But that response, to me, I think of, again, the Bracefield case, where the Supreme Court was so decisive and certain about the impediment. Obviously, the jury in that case knew how it was divided. The judge asked, after several hours of deliberation, what's the numerical division? Well, certainly the jury knew it. Mm-hmm. So the fact that the jury already knew doesn't really go to the issue of coercion. I don't hear it responding to that issue.
I missed the case you're referring to as Brassfield.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the one that your opposing counsel mentioned. It also has some language regarding whether or not the defendant has to make a particularized exception. But for the facts, and assume the facts, because are in that case that after several hours of deliberation, the judge inquired of the jury what their numerical split was.
As I indicated in my brief, this case stands on quite different footing than inquiring into the numerical division of the jury prior to when a verdict has already been reached. In that particular case, as in Brassfield or McMahon, the Court of Appeals case in this jurisdiction, that type of numerical inquiry has no purpose. Whereas here, a polling will necessarily reveal the numerical division of the jury. And it's an obvious consequence of the polling process if a juror has a hesitation or dissents from the verdict. But jury polling, in contrast to numerical inquiries, has a purpose. It preserves the right to a unanimous and uncoerced verdict. What the judge here was trying to ascertain was whether Foreman Clark's verdict was coerced by the other jurors. And I would agree that there's always going to be some potential coercion if the judge is speaking to a juror in this manner. But you have to look at the totality of the circumstances to figure out whether coercion exists in a particular case. You can't make a bright-line rule that says, well, the continuation of the polling in and of itself is coercive, or singling him out and questioning him individually is coercive. You have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And as Justice Kurtz mentioned, in this particular case, the trial court was very careful in telling the juror twice that this should not be construed as pressure to change his vote, and he should be able to feel free to vote his conscience.
What about State versus Wheezy? In the event of a dissent polling, the trial court can either send the jury back to continual deliberations where the trial court may determine that further deliberations would be fruitless and grant a mistrial. You've got a situation here where you've got, according to the defense position, a dissent. This is not my verdict. And there's about three different ways in the transcript that he says, no, that's not really what I'm saying. That's not my position. When you get that dissent under Wheezy, don't you just send it back and say, okay, go figure out where you are?
I submit that under Wheezy, the third option here, the inquiry into the ambiguity, that's implicit in Wheezy, even though Wheezy discusses the two options that are available under the ABA standards. But in footnote 3 in Wheezy, it talks about, did the trial court afford the juror the opportunity to make an unambiguous reply? Second, did the court ask appropriate non-coercive neutral questions to clarify any apparent juror confusion? And third, did the trial court avoid repetitive questioning until a particular answer was given by the juror? In this case, we don't have a case like Sincox or some of the other cases that my opponent cites. The court here did not engage in a coercive, repetitive questioning to get the juror to agree to one viewpoint or another.
Ms. Larson, I know that this was a backup position, but my understanding was that in your brief, you took the position that if there was error here, it was harmless. What I found interesting was that you didn't use the Chapman case or the Nader case or any of our more recent cases on harmless error, but used some rather old cases. And I'm a little bit curious as to why you did that.
Well, upon further reflection, I'm not sure I would characterize it as a harmless error inquiry as so much as a totality of the circumstances approach. If you look here to the trial testimony, I think my opponent mischaracterizes what the trial testimony was here. The chemist did actually testify that based on the average rates of alcohol absorption and elimination, Mr. Ray's alcohol level at the time of the stop would be between 0.10 and 0.11. It was only on cross-examination that the expert did not have an opinion as to his blood alcohol level, but that hypothetical was based on facts that were not in the case as to the times.
But isn't your argument really that the evidence was so strong here, supporting conviction, that even if the judge mishandled the jury polling, that it was harmless in nature? I know you're now saying totality of the circumstances, but isn't that really another way of saying this was harmless error?
Right, you could characterize it as harmless error. But this court in Eccles had determined that you do have to look at whether the evidence was strong. And that's simply one of the factors in determining the coerciveness of the trial court's procedures. It makes the fact that the evidence was strong makes an uncoerced verdict very likely. Similarly, the absence of any other errors in the trial reduces the possibility that this juror's vote was based on something other than the merits of the case. Similarly, an acquittal on the other charge also indicates that this juror wasn't vulnerable to coercion because they did, in fact, acquit Mr. Ray of the OWI charge.
One of the things that your opposing counsel is arguing essentially is what's ambiguous about no. You know, what part of no don't you understand?
Right.
And I use a hypothetical and kind of flip the facts. If I were a trial judge and it was voir dire, and the jury was being asked, or the juror was being asked, can you be fair and impartial in this case? A standard question in voir dire, and jury selection. That's those are the questions we ask when we select the jury. That's a fancy name for it, voir dire. And if I ask that question, are you able to be a fair and impartial juror? And the juror says, equivocates, fill in the blanks, okay. And I ask, well, are you able to be a fair and impartial juror? And the juror says, I've got a question. And gives me the question, and I answer it. And then I say, are you able to be a fair and impartial juror? And the juror says, yes, or the juror says no, I stop. I mean, once I get a yes without yes, I think so, maybe, you know, I mean, that's the kind of answers you often get. Well, maybe yes, I think I could, sort of, you know, then we have to, that's ambiguous. You know. But once I get a yes or I get a no, I would stop right there. I mean, I wouldn't say, well, are you sure? You know, I mean,
and he persuades you.
Yeah, I'd close my file and go to the next juror then, you know. So you have that here. You have, I think, undoubtedly some, obviously, ambiguity when he says, I have a question, you know, in response. But then the follow-up question was asked, and he said, no. Well, why isn't that the end of it then, in terms of, okay, we don't have a unanimous jury, send it back?
Well, we simply can't tell from the cold record what this juror was doing or what he was looking like, what his tone of voice. Obviously, Mr. Howe was there. I was not there. But the trial court is in a much better position than this court to determine whether his eventual response was in fact his response or was in fact freely given.
I agree with that, and I think I've even written on that. When you have, yeah, I think so, or, you know, that kind of, when there's some additional language that would suggest, but when you have a yes, you have a no, seems like that's it.
The state submits that you just cannot have a bright line rule saying that the court must stop at that point, because a bright line rule requiring the court to immediately send the jury back or immediately declare a mistrial, that kind of a rule may be intended to be clear, but if it's applied in various ambiguous situations, we have to allow the trial court to have discretion as to what to do in that instance. So, in other words, I can't say what an ideal response of the trial court should have been or what the precise methodology should be. Methodology. But other courts in other jurisdictions have found error when the trial court fails to clarify and just simply accepts the verdict as true. I would also submit that the limited exchange that occurred between the judge and the juror serves to promote the efficient administration of justice, because if the court would have just sent the jury back right then and there, that might not have been necessary. Further deliberations may not have been necessary. In this particular case, they were necessary, because the juror ultimately said, no, it's not my verdict, and I have a question about this aspect of the testimony, as well as the other jurors. They also have this same question. But a limited exchange might avert unwarranted delay in further deliberation, or even more, it might obviate the need for a new trial if the jurors could have been sent back for further deliberations instead of the court immediately declaring a mistrial. In other words, and going to what Justice Crooks was asking me before, or maybe it was Justice Wilcox. Any defect in the court's procedures might have been cured by a subsequent polling that indicated unanimous verdict. I'd just like to mention one other point about the court questioning the juror in open court, but outside the presence of the other jurors. There have been other jurisdictions that have said that that might be a preferred method rather than questioning the juror in front of the other jurors. And that way, the juror is free to express his opinion in a setting away from the coercive influences that might have dominated the deliberations. The Supreme Court of Illinois held that in the Kellogg case. In other words, the polling procedure is designed to make sure that the verdict is unanimous and is uncoerced. But if you're asking the juror in the presence of the other jurors, the juror may not be forthright. Whereas in front of the court by himself, he might feel free to answer the questions in a truthful manner. The other thing is the objection, the absence of the objection to the polling by trial counsel permits the inference here that the procedures utilized did not appear coercive to those participating in the trial. So even if this court does not find waiver, it's a strong indication that coercion was not present in this case. Furthermore, the court, as I said before, twice told the juror that the questions posed to him should not be construed as pressure to change his vote. So those are some of the factors to consider under the totality of the circumstances, whether the polling procedures were coercive. The continued polling is only one factor in this analysis, but it should not be held as per se error simply because the polling continued. Continued polling has been found to be okay in a number of other jurisdictions, federal and state jurisdictions. Furthermore, you could argue that the continued polling actually may benefit the defendant because it may give other jurors courage to dissent if they maybe were not otherwise going to dissent. You could argue that, particularly here because this was the jury foreman who had this question. So it goes both ways. The court here was trying to be helpful and trying to see if anything would assist the juror. All jury verdicts are rendered with some kind of discussion about evidence and jury instructions. And here, it's just clear that this particular juror had a question about the evidence. After the transcript was prepared, the jury came back unanimous, and there was no question about it the second time around. There's no evidence in this record to show that the jury was enraged or that they were hostile towards this jury foreman in the brief 5-minute or less period of time that the court was questioning this juror. My opponent is saying that the tendency of the questions to be coercive in and of themselves is the problem. But I submit that you have to point to something in the record that is coercive, not just the individual questioning of the juror in and of itself.
Ms. Larson, I'm wondering if you can help me out. I seem to recall, and I haven't been able to find it quickly, cases discussing whether should we construe that there was an error here and should we construe that it affects the unanimous jury verdict, whether the right to a unanimous verdict can ever be harmless. In your research in preparing for this case, did you come across any cases that discussed one way or the other whether a right to a unanimous verdict can or cannot be harmless here? Is it structural?
Right. I did not actually specifically research that question, but I would say that if the verdict is not unanimous, that can never be harmless. But what I was getting at was that in this
instance... You think it's not, we don't have that problem?
No. Sorry. No. I think that what I'm getting at is that the court's procedures here cannot be construed as coercive under the totality of the circumstances, and it was a completely appropriate exercise of the court's discretion to do what it did. Unorthodox, maybe, but we can't say that this was a wrong thing for the court to do. I think that the judge in this case might have been surprised by this juror's question and didn't quite know what to do. But I think we'd have the same situation if the court would have done what my opponent wants and asked the questions immediately then in front of the presence of the other jurors. He would probably still be arguing that that is coercive also.
The only way you could get to a non-unanimous verdict, I assume, is to find that this was coercive, because ultimately the jury did come out with a guilty verdict.
Right. If this court finds that what happened in this situation was coercive, this court would have to remand for a new trial. But I don't think that that happened in this case. On the finding of ambiguity, this court should defer to the trial court's determination that ambiguity existed. That's the Cartagena case. But I also submit that a finding of ambiguity is not necessarily required to allow the court to have this limited inquiry of the juror.
Well, under Wheezy, how do you get there unless you find an ambiguity?
Right. This court would have to modify Wheezy in that regard. But I think that if this court wanted to make a bright-line rule, you could say the court should be able to do what it feels necessary in this situation to clarify a juror's response, whether it's ambiguous or hesitant or any number of things could happen. A juror could say a limitless possibility of things, and you just can't make a bright-line rule to address all the possible responses of what a juror could say or do or his demeanor.
Are you suggesting, then, a bright-line rule of deference? In other words, are you suggesting a bright-line rule that the court should always defer to the circuit court in its determination of ambiguity?
That's what I'm saying, that the trial court is in the better position to determine whether ambiguity existed. But the ultimate question is whether the court's procedures were coercive. And that, you could argue, is a de novo type of review.
A question of law.
Yes.
The
historical fact of as to whether the juror was ambiguous or not, that should be an erroneous exercise of discretion standard of review. Because I don't think there's any way that this court or an appellate court could make that determination on a record. Even a yes answer could be construed as ambiguous given the juror's demeanor or tone of voice. There have been cases where a juror says yes but is crying. That's ambiguous in the case law. We just don't know.
What would your position be if the juror here said, I have a question, and the judge said, first answer the clerk. And is it the jury's verdict? Yes. Is it your verdict? Yes. Would you say that was ambiguous? The yes was ambiguous?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat the first part of your question?
Yeah. Everything's the same.
Mm-hmm.
Clark is polled. Is this the jury's verdict? Clark answers yes, as he did here.
Mm-hmm.
Then the question is it your verdict? And Clark says, I have a question. The judge says, no, answer the clerk's question. Is it your verdict? And Clark says yes. You think that yes is ambiguous?
It could be, but we don't know.
Well, and then suppose the judge did exactly what he did here.
Right.
You think sometimes, that would be all right?
Yes, because sometimes a juror's answer is merely unnecessary explanation of why he or she decided what he or she did, and it's not really a dissent or an ambiguity. It's just explaining why, you know, if a juror says, well, I wasn't sure at first, but then I looked at all the evidence, and now I'm sure. And yes, it's my verdict. It's not really ambiguous. Here, the facts of the case, under the totality of the circumstances, clearly demonstrate that no coercion was present. First, there was no objection by counsel to the court's polling procedures until a very late point in time where he made a motion for mistrial. But not at any point in the time of questioning or voir dire of this juror, he never objected. The court twice told the juror that he shouldn't feel pressured to vote, to change his vote, and he should feel free to vote his conscience. There was no kind of prolonged colloquy to make him change his vote, nothing like Sincox, where the court was saying, are you sure that's your verdict? Do you understand the difference between guilty and not guilty? Nothing like that happened here. The court was trying to be helpful, giving the juror a transcript. As I mentioned, it might be less coercive to question a juror outside the presence of the other jurors, because the juror might be more truthful with the judge without facing the other jurors. But again, no bright line rule can be made. We don't know, in the totality of the circumstances, it might be better to question him outside the presence of the jurors. also submit that the approach taken by the Second Circuit in United States versus Gambino, which is 951 Fed Second 498, it's a 1991 Second Circuit case, that court crafts a rule that is grounded in sound reasoning and maintains an appropriate standard of review. That is, this court should review the trial court's polling procedures for an erroneous exercise of discretion, looking to the totality of the circumstances to determine whether the polling procedures were coercive. And as I mentioned, there's a number of factors to take into account. And I can go over those again if you'd like, but they are clearly set forth in the Second Circuit in Gambino. The only circuit that makes a per se rule is the Third Circuit, I believe. Pardon me, 11th Circuit in Spitz, which is S-P-I-T-Z. But all of the other cases that my research revealed adopt a much more flexible, erroneous exercise of discretion or totality of the circumstances approach. So this per se rule that my opponent advocates is not really desirable. It robs the court of the ability to ascertain whether a dissent even exists. It robs the trial court of control over the proceedings. And there's no real way to indicate the best method in every single case. So this court should give the trial court discretion and should affirm the trial court's procedures here as an appropriate exercise of discretion because the trial court's procedures were not coercive. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Howe.
With regard to the issue of ambiguity, I would like to underscore the point that the trial judge in this case thanked the juror for his forthrightness. The trial judge found the verdict to be non-unanimous. These two statements occurred before the questioning of the juror, before all of this took place. Once the judge made those statements on the record, I believe it would be impossible for this court to conclude that the trial judge found the juror's statements to be ambiguous. He said that their answer was forthright. There is no ambiguity here, and therefore, there is no third option as set forth under White, Wheezy, or Cartagena.
I think the point of the state was that there may have been an ambiguity. The point is, at which point was the ambiguity clarified? The juror did ask a question, correct?
Correct.
So at that point, I think you had an ambiguity. When the court continued with the polling, the juror said no. That's when you're asserting there is no ambiguity.
Correct.
Correct?
Yes.
But I think to say there's no ambiguity here, I think misses the first part of the analysis.
I'm sorry, you are correct. You are correct. The judge did find the juror's statements to be forthright. And I don't think we can conclude that the forthright conclusion by the judge meant that the judge thought that there was ambiguity. There being no ambiguity at that point in time, when the juror says no, you cannot proceed to the third option as set forth under Wheezy. Which brings me to the next point, which is whether or not there was coercion here. Is it coercive for the trial judge to continue to question a juror when the juror says he does not assent to the verdict? It is. Brasfield does not elaborate on why it's coercive to reveal the numerical split in the jurors deliberating. Brasfield says that its tendency is coercive. Revealing the split can rarely be resorted to without bringing to bear in some degree serious, although not measurable, an improper influence on the jury, from whose deliberations every consideration other than that of the evidence and the law as expounded in a proper charge should be excluded. I don't think we can get around this problem. If I can't prove that it was coercive, I don't think that should be my burden. Where the judge makes an error, as in this case, I think we have If I cannot point to the coercion, the court should infer that the continuation of the poll, questioning of the juror, all of the above amounts to coercion. Even though I would submit I don't have the burden of establishing the degree of coercion exerted, I would point to the court. The judge did ask some questions which I would submit do amount to coercion. In my appendix on the primary brief I submitted, page 15, the court stated to the juror, "You ultimately listened to the other jurors, were convinced and persuaded by their argument, and changed your vote based upon that collective analysis of the evidence. Is that what you are telling us?" That is a leading question. If when the judge speaks, as we all know, his words are so crucial to that juror, and when that judge asks the juror a leading question, we can't conclude that he's not pushing him in a direction. We can't. As a trial lawyer, I try to push the witnesses as hard as I can with leading questions. That was a leading question. That's a nudge in the direction of assent. And he didn't assent at that moment, but he came back with an assent. I don't believe on this record we can conclude that there was no coercion. And I would add that I don't think I have the burden to prove that there was coercion. It was inherently coercive for the trial judge to question the juror about his no verdict. He said no, period. It should have been the end of the inquiry. But now we have this problem where he continued with questions. He asked leading questions. And he misinformed the juror as to what the law is. And he told the juror that a compromised verdict is acceptable. How is that juror supposed to understand what that meant? Maybe he understood it wrong. We don't know. That was a bad instruction. And so here we are. And
Mr. Howell, let's assume for purposes of this question only,
yes,
that we agree that there is a problem here. We agree that the scheme of things that occurred in the trial court was coercive to this jury. And as a result, we construe this to be a violation of the right to unanimous jury verdict. I want to ask you the same question I asked Ms. Larson. As part of your research in preparing for this case, did you ascertain whether or not the violation of a right to a unanimous jury verdict is subject to a harmless error analysis, or is it structural error that can never be harmless? Or did you look into that?
I cannot answer that question. But I would submit to the court my opinion, which is that this is the type of error that cannot be waived. We're talking about an individual whose liberty is at stake. If there are coercive tendencies in the verdict to the juror in their deliberations, we can't convict under those circumstances. That can't be waived away. A coerced verdict is not sustainable. I don't think the court should allow that to take place.
We once had a case where there was no alternate and there was 11 jurors. And the question is whether you could go ahead. The only problem is, Mr. Howe, I can't remember how we answered the question.
So,
I think that's what I'm thinking about.
Your time is up. And thank you for your argument, Mr. Howe, and thank you, Ms. Larson, for your arguments in this case. We haven't had a jury case for a while, and polling a jury in a long time. So that ends our hearing in 04-0770CR. And we'll take a few moments of recess to allow these students to leave if they wish, and we will have other students enter the court. Thank you.